The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
The Lottery by Shirley Jackson. The morning of June 27th was clear and sunny. With the fresh warmth of a full summer day, the flowers were blossoming profusely and the grass was richly green. The people of the village began to gather in the square between the post office and the bank around 10 o'clock. In some towns, there were so many people that the lottery took 2 days and had to be started on June 26th. But in this village, where there were only about 300 people, the whole lottery took only about 2 hours, so it could begin at 10 o'clock in the morning and still be through in time to allow the villagers to get home for noon dinner. The children assembled first, of course. School was recently over for the summer, and the feeling of liberty sat uneasily on most of them. They tended to gather together quietly for a while before they broke into boisterous play, and their talk was still of the classroom and the teacher, of books and reprimands. Bobby Martin had already stuffed his pockets full of stones, and the other boys soon followed his example, selecting the smoothest and roundest stones. Bobby and Harry Jones and Dickie Delacroix eventually made a great pile of stones in one corner of the square and guarded it against the raids of the other boys. The girls stood aside, talking among themselves, looking over their shoulders at the boys, and the very small children rolled in the dust or clung to the hands of their older brothers or sisters. Soon the men began to gather, surveying their own children, speaking of planting and rain, tractors and taxes. They stood together, away from the pile of stones in the corner, and their jokes were quiet, and they smiled rather than laughed. The women, wearing faded house dresses and sweaters, came shortly after their menfolk. They greeted one another and exchanged bits of gossip as they went to join their husbands. Soon the women standing by their husbands began to call to their children, and the children came reluctantly, having to be called 4 or 5 times. Bobby Martin ducked his under his mother's grasping hand and ran laughing back to the pile of stones. His father spoke up sharply, and Bobby came quickly and took his place between his father and his oldest brother. The lottery was conducted, as were the square dances, the teenage club, the Halloween program, by Mr. Summers, who had time and energy to devote to civic activities. He was a round-faced, jovial man, and he ran the coal business, and people were sorry for him because he had no children, and his wife was a scold. When he arrived in the square carrying the black wooden box, there was a murmur of conversation among the villagers, and he waved and called, "Little late today, folks." The postmaster, Mr. Graves, followed him, carrying a three-legged stool, and the stool was put in the center of the square, and Mr. Summers set the black box down on it. The villagers kept their distance, leaving a space between themselves and the stool, and when Mr. Summers said, "Some of you fellows want to give me a hand," there was a hesitation before two men, Mr. Martin and the oldest son Baxter, came forward to hold the box steady on the stool while Mr. Summers stirred up the papers inside it. The original paraphernalia for the lottery had been long lost, and the box, the black box, now resting on the stool, had been put into use even before Old Man Warner, the oldest man in town, was born. Mr. Summers spoke frequently to the villagers about making a new box, but no one liked to upset even as much tradition as was represented by the black box. There was a story that the present box had been made with some pieces of the box that had preceded it. the one that had been constructed when the first people settled down to make a village here. Every year after the lottery, Mr. Summers began talking again about a new box. But every year the subject was allowed to fade off without anyone's being done. The black box grew shabbier each year. By now it was no longer completely black, but splintered badly along one side to show the original wood color, and in some places faded or stained. Mr. Martin and his oldest son Baxter held the black box securely on the stool until Mr. Summers had stirred the papers thoroughly with his hand. Because so much of the ritual had been forgotten or discarded, Mr. Summers had been successful in having slips of paper substituted for the chips of wood that had been used for generations. Chips of wood, Mr. Summers had argued, had been all very well when the village was tiny, but now that the population was more than 300 and likely to keep on growing, it was necessary to use something that would fit more easily into the black box. The night before the lottery, Mr. Summers and Mr. Graves made up the slips of paper and put them into the box, and it was then taken to the safe of Mr. Summers' coal company and locked up until Mr. Summers was ready to take it to the square the next morning. The rest of the year, the box was put away, sometimes one place, sometimes another. It had spent one year in Mr. Graves' barn and another year underfoot in the post office, and sometimes it was set on a shelf in the Martin grocery and left there. There was a great deal of fussing to be done before Mr. Summers declared the lottery open. There were the lists to make up of heads of families, heads of households in each family, members of each household in each family. There was the proper swearing in of Mr. Summers by the postmaster as the official of the lottery. At one time, some people remembered, there had been a recital of some sort performed by the official of the lottery, a perfunctory, tuneless chant that had been rattled off duly each year. Some people believed that the official of the lottery used it to stand just so when he said it or sang it. Others believed that he was supposed to walk among the people. But years and years ago, this part of the ritual had been allowed to lapse. There had been also a ritual salute, which the official of the lottery had had to use in addressing each person who came up to draw from the box. But this also had changed with time. Until now, it was felt necessary only for the official to speak to each person approaching. Mr. Summers was very good at this. In his clean white shirt and blue jeans, with one hand resting carelessly on the black box, he seemed very proper and important as he talked interminably to Mr. Graves and the Martins. Just as Mr. Summers finally left off talking to the assembled villagers, Mrs. Hutchinson came hurrying along the path to the square, her sweater thrown over her shoulders and slid into place at the back of the crowd. "Clean forgot what day it was," she said to Mrs. Delacroix, who stood next to her, and they both laughed softly. "Thought my old man was out back stacking wood," Mrs. Hutchinson went on. "And then I looked out the window and the kids was gone, and then I remembered it was the 27th and came a-running." She dried her hands on her apron, and Mrs. Delacroix said, "You're in time, though. They're still talking away up there." Mrs. Hutchinson craned her neck to see through the crowd and found her husband and children standing near the front. She tapped Mrs. Delacroix on the arm as a farewell and then began to make her way through the crowd. The people separated good-humoredly to let her through. Two or three people said in voices just loud enough to be heard across the crowd, "Here comes your Mrs. Hutchinson." "And Bill, she made it after all." Mrs. Hutchinson reached her husband, and Mr. Summers, who had been waiting, said cheerfully, "Thought we were going to have to get on without you, Tessie." Mrs. Hutchinson said, grinning, "Wouldn't have me leave my dishes in the sink now, would you, Joe?" And soft laughter ran through the crowd as the people stirred back into position after Mrs. Hutchinson's arrival. "Well, now," Mr. Summers said soberly, "guess we better get started, get this over with, so's we can go back to work. Anybody ain't here?" "Dunbar," several people said. "Dunbar, Dunbar." Mr. Summers consulted his list. "Clyde Dunbar," he said. "That's right, he's broke his leg, hasn't he? Who's drawing for him?" "Me, I guess," a woman said, and Mr. Summers turned to look at her. "Wife draws for her husband." Mr. Summers said. Don't you have a grown boy to do it for you, Janey? Although Mr. Summers and everyone else in the village knew the answer perfectly well, it was the business of the official of the lottery to ask such questions formally. Mr. Summers waited with an expression of polite interest while Mrs. Dunbar answered. Horace is not but 16 yet, Mrs. Dunbar said regretfully. Guess I gotta fill in for the old man this year. Right, Mr. Summers said. He made a note on the list he was holding. Then he asked, Watson boy drawing this year? A tall boy in the crowd raised his hand. Here, he said. I'm drawing for my mother and me. He blinked his eyes nervously and ducked his head as several voices in the crowd said things like, Good fellow, Jack, and glad to see your mother's got a man to do it. Well, said Mr. Summers, guess that's everyone. Old man Warner, make it. Here, a voice said, and Mr. Summers nodded. A sudden hush fell on the crowd as Mr. Summers cleared his throat and looked at the list. All ready? He called. Now I'll read the names, heads of families first, and the men come up and take a paper out of the box. Keep the paper folded in your hand without looking at it until everyone has had a turn. Everything clear? The people had done it so many times that they only half listened to the directions. Most of them were quiet, wetting their lips, not looking around. Then Mr. Summers raised one hand high and said, Adams. A man disengaged himself from the crowd and came forward. Hi, Steve, Mr. Summers said, and Mr. Adams said, Hi, Joe. They grinned at one another humorously and nervously. Then Mr. Adams reached into the black box and took out a folded paper. He held it firmly by one corner as he turned and went hastily back to his place in the crowd, where he stood a little apart from his family, not looking down at his hand. Allen, Mr. Summers said. Anderson. Bentham. Seems like there's no time at all between lotteries anymore, Mrs. Delacroix said to Mrs. Graves in the back row. Seems like we got through with the last one only last week. Time goes fast, Mrs. Graves said. Clark, Delacroix, there goes my old man, Mrs. Delacroix said. She held her breath while her husband went forward. Dunbar, Mr. Summers said, and then Mrs. Dunbar went steadily to the box, while one of the women said, Go on, Janey, and another said, There she goes. We're next, Mrs. Graves said. She watched while Mr. Graves came around from the side of the box, greeted Mr. Summers gravely, and selected a slip of paper from the box. By now, all through the crowd, there were men holding the small folded papers in their large hands, turning them over and over nervously. Mrs. Dunbar and her two sons stood together, Mrs. Dunbar holding the slip of paper. Harbert Hutchinson, get up there, Bill, Mrs. Hutchinson said, and the people near her laughed. Jones. They do say, Mr. Adams said to old man Warner, who stood next to him, that over in the North Village they're talking of giving up the lottery. Old man Warner snorted. Pack of crazy fools, he said, listening to the young folks. Nothing's good enough for them. Next thing you know, they'll be wanting to go back to living in caves. Nobody work anymore, live that way for a while. Used to be a saying about lottery in June, corn be heavy soon. First thing you know, we'd all be eating stewed chicken weed and acorns. There's always been a lottery, he added petulantly. Bad enough to see young Joe Summers up there joking with everybody. Some places have already quit lotteries, Mrs. Adams said. Nothing but trouble in that, old man Warner said stoutly. Pack of young fools. Martin and Bobby Martin watched his father go forward. Overdyke, Percy. I wish they'd hurry, Mrs. Dunbar said to her older son. I wish they'd hurry. They're almost through, her son said. You get ready to run tell Dad, Mrs. Dunbar said. Mr. Summers called his own name and then stepped forward precisely and selected a slip from the box. Then he called, Warner. 77th year I been in the lottery, old man Warner said as he went through the crowd. 77th time. Watson, the tall boy, came awkwardly through the crowd. Someone said, Don't be nervous, Jack. And Mr. Summers said, Take your time, son. Zanini. After that, there was a long pause, a breathless pause, until Mr. Summers, holding his slip of paper in the air, said, All right, fellows. For a minute, no one moved. And then all the slips of paper were opened. Suddenly, all the women began to speak at once, saying, Who is it? Who's got it? Is it the Dunbars? Is it the Watsons? Then the voices began to say, It's Hutchinson. It's Bill. Bill Hutchinson's got it. "Go tell your father," Mrs. Dunbar said to her older son. People began to look around to see the Hutchinsons. Bill Hutchinson was standing quiet, staring down at the paper in his hand. Suddenly, Tessie Hutchinson shouted to Mr. Summers, "You didn't give him enough time to take any paper he wanted. I saw you. It wasn't fair." "Be a good sport, Tessie," Mrs. Delacroix called. And Mrs. Graves said, "All of us took the same chance." "Shut up, Tessie," Bill Hutchinson said. "Well, everyone," Mr. Summers said, "that was done pretty fast, and now we've got to be hurrying a little more to get it done in time." He consulted his next list. "Bill," he said, "you draw for the Hutchinson family. You got any other households in the Hutchinsons?" "There's Don and Eva," Mrs. Hutchinson yelled. Make them take their chance." "Daughters draw with their husbands' families, Tessie," Mr. Summers said gently. "You know that as well as anyone else." "It wasn't fair," Tessie said. "I guess not, Joe," Bill Hutchinson said regretfully. "My daughter draws with her husband's family. That's only fair. And I've got no other family except the kids." "Then, as far as drawing for families is concerned, it's you," Mr. Summers said in explanation. "And as far as drawing for households is concerned, that's you too, right?"
"Right,"
Bill Hutchinson said. "How many kids, Bill?" Mr. Summers asked formally. "Three," Bill Hutchinson said. "There's Bill, Jr., and Nancy, and little Dave, and Tessie and me." "All right, then," Mr. Summers said. "Harry, you got their tickets back?" Mr. Graves nodded and held up the slips of paper. "Put them in the box, then. Take Bill's and put it in." "I think we ought to start over," Mrs. Hutchinson said as quietly as she could. "I tell you, it wasn't fair. You didn't give him time enough to choose. Everybody saw that." Mr. Graves had selected the five slips and put them in the box, and he dropped all the papers but those onto the ground, where the breeze caught them and lifted them off. "Listen, everybody," Mrs. Hutchinson was saying to the people around her. "Ready, Bill?" Mr. Summers asked, and Bill Hutchinson, with one quick glance around at his wife and children, nodded. "Remember," Mr. Summers said, "take the slips and keep them folded until each person has taken one. Harry, you help little Dave." Mr. Graves took the hand of the little boy, who came willingly with him up to the box. "Take a paper out of the box, Davy," Mr. Summers said. Davy put his hand into the box and laughed. "Take just one paper," Mr. Summers said. "Harry, you hold it for him." Mr. Graves took the child's hand to remove the folded paper from the tight fist and held it while little Dave stood next to him and looked up at him wonderingly. "Nancy next," Mr. Summers said. Nancy was 12, and her school friends breathed heavily as she went forward, switching her skirt, and took a slip daintily from the box. "Bill Jr.," Mr. Summers said, and Billy, his face red and his feet overlarge, nearly knocked the box over as he got a paper out. "Tessie," Mr. Summers said. She hesitated for a minute, looking about defiantly, and then set her lips and went up to the box. She snatched the paper out and held it behind her. "Bill," Mr. Summers said, and Bill Hutchinson reached into the box and felt around, bringing his hand out at last with a slip of paper in it. The crowd was quiet. A girl whispered, "I hope it's not Nancy," and the sound of the whisper reached the edges of the crowd. "It's not the way it used to be," Old Man Warner said clearly. "People ain't the way they used to be." "All right," Mr. Summers said, "open the papers. Harry, you open little Dave's." Mr. Graves opened the slip of paper, and there was a general sigh through the crowd as he held it up, and everyone could see that it was blank. Nancy and Bill Jr. opened theirs at the same time, and both beamed and laughed, turning around to the crowd and holding their slips of paper above their heads. "Tessie," Mr. Summers said. There was a pause, and then Mr. Summers looked at Bill Hutchinson, and Bill unfolded his paper and showed it. It was blank. "It's Tessie," Mr. Summers said, and his voice was hushed. "Show us her paper, Bill." Bill Hutchinson went over to his wife and forced the slip of paper out of her hand. It had a black spot on it, the black spot Mr. Summers had made the night before with the heavy pencil in the cool company office. But Hutchinson held it up, and there was a stir in the crowd. "All right, folks," Mr. Summers said, "let's finish quickly." Although the villagers had forgotten the ritual and lost the original black box, they still remembered to use stones. The pile of stones the boys had made earlier was ready. There were stones on the ground with the blowing scraps of paper that had come out of the box. Mrs. Delacroix selected a stone so large she had to pick it up with both hands and turned to Mrs. Dunbar. "Come on," she said. "Hurry up." Mrs. Dunbar had small stones in both hands, and she said, gasping for breath, "I can't run at all. You'll have to go ahead, and I'll catch up with you." The children had stones already, and someone gave little Davy Hutchinson a few pebbles. Tessie Hutchinson was in the center of a cleared space by now, and she held her hands out desperately as the villagers moved in on her. "It isn't fair," she said. A stone hit her on the side of the head. Old Man Warner was saying, "Come on, come on, everyone." Steve Adams was in the front of the crowd of villagers with Mr. Graves beside him. "It isn't fair. It isn't right," Mrs. Hutchinson screamed. And then they were upon her. This is a little short piece called The Bell by Joanne Harris. In a village by the edge of a forest, there lived a woodcutter's family. They were poor. They lived from the land, and the land was far from generous. They ate black bread and roots and seeds and small fish from the river, but they were free and happy, except perhaps for the woodcutter's son, who longed for something different. In all his life, the woodcutter's son had never drunk wine or eaten bread that was not black and unleavened. In all his life, he had never worn clothes that had not been first worn by someone else. And he was always listening to tales of ancient kings and queens, their wealth, their adventures, their glamour, and longing for the old days when things were very different. He often asked his father where those ancient kings and queens had gone and how their kingdoms had fallen. But his father would always tell him, "That was long before my time. No one remembers the old days now." The boy was disappointed, but he still did not forget the tales of knights and ladies, kings and queens. He would often roam the forest alone, searching for signs of the old days. Sometimes he even found them, pieces of masonry sunk in the ground, scattered fragments of colored glass, a gilded comb, a strand of hair still caught in its ivory teeth. Then one day, in the heart of the woods, he came across a city, ruined and abandoned in the scrambling undergrowth. Great pillars of marble and arches of stone were draped in morning glories, and under an intricate vaulted dome, through which a curtain of ivy fell, he found a great gathering of stone, a feasting hall of statues. The boy walked through the hall of stone. On either side, lords and ladies, some holding goblets to their lips, some laughing, some dancing, some hiding their smiles behind their painted ivory fans. On the tables between them, platters of fruit and cakes were spread out, all in stone, and perfect, even to the water droplets on the bunches of grapes. Above them, a minstrel's gallery, is music silenced, except for the drip of water from the ceiling. At either side of the room, stone guards in their helmets and armor. And at the head of the great hall, the king and queen of the city sat on thrones of polished marble. And to the boy, they looked both wise and very, very beautiful. "What happened here?" he said aloud. A voice spoke up behind him. It was that of a ragged old crone hiding among the statues. "I remember all this," she said. "I was a servant in this place. Oh, it was a beautiful in no time, a place of joy and music, but it fell under a spell, a curse, and its people were all turned into stone." The boy's eyes widened. He could already imagine himself a member of that gilded throng. He saw himself dancing with beautiful girls and eating all kinds of sweetmeats. His father would wear furs, he thought, his sisters gowns of silken brocade. "If only the curse could be broken," he said. "Oh, but it can," the old crone replied, her dark eyes gleaming like gemstones. "All it needs is for one brave boy to ring that big old bell up there." And she pointed to a great brass bell hanging from the ceiling in a mass of vines and spiderwebs. "And that will bring them back?" said the boy. The old crone nodded. "A single note would be enough to awaken them." The boy looked up and started to climb. It was a difficult, dangerous task, but finally he reached the bell, pulled its clapper free, and it rang. The brass note shimmered in the air like a cloud of fireflies, and slowly below him, the courtiers of stone began to awaken, began to move. The beautiful ladies shifted and yawned. The guards stood to attention. Laughter rang once more through the hall that had been silent for hundreds of years. But somehow, the joyful scene was not quite the way the boy had imagined it. There was something about the laughter that came from the thrones of the courtiers, a cruel and acquisitive look in the eyes of the ladies. The boy clambered down from the ceiling and waited for someone to notice him. "Surely my reward will come," he thought, looking at the magnificent feast and imagining all the things he would buy with the gold they would give him. But instead of showing their gratitude, the beautiful king and queen just spread their wings and watched the boy with hungry eyes. The courtiers and their ladies, too, crowded round the frightened boy, licking their lips and smiling. The music from the gallery began to play, an evil tune that made his head spin and sent his pulses racing. The boy grew pale and turned to run, but there was nowhere to run to, and the queen put her thin white hand on his neck and drew him close, smiling. When they had finished with the boy, the king and queen and their courtiers and guards took wing and flew over the land like locusts. They enslaved the people, slaughtered their flocks, burnt down their homes and their settlements. For centuries, the enchantment had kept them tame and helpless. Now, at last, they were awake, and they had no mercy. Back in the deserted hall, the old crone shrugged her shoulders and smiled. "Before you ring the bell," she said, "be sure to know what tune it plays." And at that, she turned and went into the woods, leaving the stone hall empty. The Hanging Stranger by Philip K. Dick. 5 o'clock, Ed Lois washed up, tossed on his hat and coat, got his car out, and headed across town toward his TV sales store. He was tired. His back and shoulders ached from digging dirt out of the basement and wheeling it into the backyard. But for a 40-year-old man, he had done okay. Janet could get a new vase with the money he had saved, and he liked the idea of repairing the foundation himself. It was getting dark. The setting sun cast long rays over the scurrying commuters. Tired and grim-faced, women loaded down with bundles and packages, students swarming home from the university, mixing with clerks and businessmen and drab secretaries. He stopped his Packard for a red light and then started it up again. The store had been open without him. He'd arrived just in time to spell the help for dinner, go over the records of the day, maybe even close a couple of sales himself. He drove slowly past the small square of green in the center of the street, the town park. There were no parking places in front of Lois TV Sales and Service. He cursed under his breath and swung the car in a U-turn. Again, he passed the little square of green with its lonely drinking fountain and bench and single lamppost. From the lamppost, something was hanging, a shapeless, dark bundle, swinging a little with the wind, like a dummy of some sort. Lois rolled down his window and peered out. What the hell was it? A display of some kind? Sometimes the Chamber of Commerce put up displays in the square. Again, he made a U-turn and brought his car around. He passed the park and concentrated on the dark bundle. It wasn't a dummy. And if it was a display, it was a strange kind. The hackles on his neck rose, and he swallowed uneasily. Sweat slid out on his face and hands. It was a body. A human body. "Look at it," Lois snapped. "Come on out here." Don Ferguson came slowly out of the store, buttoning his pinstripe coat with dignity. "This is a big deal, Ed. I can't just leave the guy standing there. See it?" Ed pointed into the gathering gloom. The lamppost jutted up against the sky, the post and the bundle swinging from it. "There it is. How the hell long has it been there? His voice rose excitedly. What's wrong with everybody? They just walk on past. Don Ferguson lit a cigarette slowly. Take it easy, old man. There must be a good reason or it wouldn't be there. A reason? What kind of reason? Ferguson shrugged. Like the time the Traffic Safety Council put that wrecked Buick there. Some sort of civic thing. How would I know? Jack Potter from the shop joined them. What's up, boys? There's a body hanging from lamppost, Lois said. I'm going to call the cops. They must know about it, Potter said, or otherwise it wouldn't be there. I got to get back in. Ferguson headed back into the store. Business before pleasure. Lois began to get historical. You see it? You see it hanging there? A man's body? A dead man? Sure, Ed. I saw it this afternoon when I went out for coffee. You mean it's been there all afternoon? Sure. What's the matter? Potter glanced at his watch. Have to run. See you later, Ed. Potter hurried off, joining the flow of people moving along the sidewalk. Men and women passing by the park. A few glanced up curiously at the dark bundle and then went on. Nobody stopped. Nobody paid any attention. I'm going nuts, Lois whispered. He made his way to the curb and crossed out into traffic among the cars. Horns honked angrily at him. He gained the curb and stepped up onto the little square of green. The man had been middle-aged. His clothing was ripped and torn, a gray suit splashed and caked with dried mud. A stranger. Lois had never seen him before, not a local man. His face was partly turned away, and in the evening wind he spun a little, turning gently, silently. His skin was gouged and cut. Red gashes, deep scratches of congealed blood. A pair of steel-rimmed glasses hung from one ear, dangling foolishly. His eyes bulged, his mouth was open, tongue thick and ugly blue. For heaven's sakes, Lois muttered, sickened. He pushed down his nausea and made his way back to the sidewalk. He was shaking all over with revulsion and fear. Why? Who was the man? Why was he hanging there? What did it mean? And why didn't anybody notice? He bumped into a small man hurrying along the sidewalk. Watch it, the man grated. Oh, it's you, Ed. Ed nodded dazedly. Hello, Jenkins. What's the matter? The stationary clerk caught Ed's arm. You look sick. The body. There, in the park. Sure, Ed. Jenkins led him into the alcove of Lois TV Sales and Service. Take it easy. Margaret Henderson from the jewelry store joined them. Something wrong? Ed's not feeling well. Lois yanked himself free. How can you stand there? Don't you see it? For God's sake. What's he talking about? Margaret asked nervously. The body, Ed shouted. The body hanging there. More people collected. Is he sick? It's Ed Lois. You okay, Ed? The body, Lois screamed, struggling to get past them. Hands caught at him. He tore loose. Let me go. The police. Get the police. Ed. Better get a doctor. He must be sick. Or drunk. Lois fought his way through the people. He stumbled and half fell. Through a blur, he saw rows of faces, curious, concerned, anxious. Men and women halting to see what the disturbance was. He fought past them toward his store. He could see Ferguson inside talking to a man, showing him an Emerson TV set. Pete Foley in the back at the service counter, setting up a new Philco. Lois shouted at them frantically. His voice was lost in the roar of traffic and the murmur around him. "Do something," he screamed. "Don't stand there. Do something. Something's wrong. Something's happened. Things are going on." The crowd melted respectfully for the two heavy-set cops moving efficiently toward Lois. "Name?" the cop with the notebook murmured. "Lois." He mopped his forehead wearily. "Edward C. Lois. Listen to me. Back there." "Address?" the cop demanded. The police car moved swiftly through traffic, shooting among the cars and buses. Lois sagged against the seat, exhausted and confused. He took a deep, shuddering breath. 1368 Hurst Road. "That's here in Pikeville?" "That's right." Lois pulled himself up with a violent effort. "Listen to me. Back there, in the square, hanging from the lamppost." "Where were you today?" the cop behind the wheel demanded. "Where?" Lois echoed. "You weren't in your shop, were you?" "No," he shook his head. "No, I was home, down in the basement." "In the basement?" "Digging. A new foundation. Getting out the dirt to pour a cement frame." "Why? What has that to do with—" "Was anybody else down there with you?" "No. My wife was downtown. My kids were at school." Lois looked from one heavy-set cop to the other. Hope flicked across his face. Wild hope. "You mean because I was down there, I missed the explanation? I didn't get in on it like everybody else?" After a pause, the cop with the notebook said, "That's right. You missed the explanation." "Then it's official? The body? It's supposed to be hanging there?" "It's supposed to be hanging there for everybody to see." Ed Lois grinned weakly. "Good Lord, I guess I sort of went off the deep end. I thought maybe something had happened, you know, something like the Ku Klux Klan, some kind of violence, communist or fascist taking over." He wiped his face with his breast pocket handkerchief, his hands shaking. "I'm glad to know it's on the level." "It's on the level." The police car was getting near the Hall of Justice. The sun had set. The streets were gloomy and dark. The lights had not yet come on. "I feel better," Lois said. "I was pretty excited there for a moment. I guess I got all stirred up. Now that I understand, there's no need to take me in, is there?" The two cops said nothing. "I should be back at my store. The boys haven't had dinner. I'm all right now. No more trouble. Is there any need of—" "This won't take long," the cop behind the wheel interrupted. "A short process. Only a few minutes." "I hope it's short," Lois muttered. The car slowed down for a stoplight. "I guess I sort of disturbed the peace. Funny, getting excited like that." And Lois yanked the door open. He sprawled out into the street and rolled to his feet. Cars were moving all around him, gaining speed as the light changed. Lois leaped onto the curb and raced among the people, burrowing into the swarming crowds. Behind him, he heard sounds, shouts, people running. They weren't cops. He had realized that right away. He knew every cop in Pikeville. A man couldn't own a store, operate a business in a small town for 25 years without getting to know all the cops. They weren't cops. And there hadn't been any explanation. Potter, Ferguson, Jenkins, none of them knew why it was there. They didn't know and they didn't care. That was the strange part. Lois ducked into a hardware store. He raced toward the back, past the startled clerks and customers, into the shipping room and through the back door. He tripped over a garbage can and ran up a flight of concrete steps. He climbed over a fence and jumped down on the other side, gasping and panting. There was no sound behind him. He had got away. He was at the entrance of an alley, dark and strewn with boards and ruined boards and boxes and tires. He could see the street at the far end. A street light wavered and came on. Men and women, stores, neon signs, cars, and to his right, the police station. He was close, terribly close. Past the loading platform of a grocery store rose the white concrete side of the Hall of Justice. Barred windows, the police antenna, a great concrete wall rising up in darkness. A bad place for him to be near. He was too close. He had to keep moving, get farther away from them. Them? Lois moved cautiously down the alley. Beyond the police station was the city hall, the old-fashioned yellow structure of wood and gilded brass and broad cement steps. He could see the endless rows of offices, dark windows, the cedars and beds of flowers on each side of the entrance, and something else. Above the city hall was a patch of darkness, a cone of gloom, denser than the surrounding night, a prism of black that spread out and was lost into the sky. He listened. Good God, he could hear something. Something that made him struggle frantically to close his ears, his mind to shut out the sound, a buzzing, a distant muted hum, like a great swarm of bees. Lois gazed up, rigid with horror, the splotch of darkness hanging over the city hall, darkness so thick it seemed almost solid. In the vortex, something moved, flickering shapes, things descending from the sky, pausing momentarily above the city hall, fluttering over it in a dense swarm and then dropping silently onto the roof. Shapes, fluttering shapes from the sky, from the crack of darkness that hung above him. He was seeing them. For a long time, Lois watched, crouched behind a sagging fence in a pool of scummy water. They were landing, coming down in groups, landing on the roof of the city hall and disappearing inside. They had wings. Like giant insects of some kind. They flew and fluttered and came to rest and then crawled crab fashion sideways across the roof and into the building. He was sickened and fascinated. Cold night wind blew around him and he shuddered. He was tired, dazed with shock. On the front steps of the city hall were men standing here and there, groups of men coming out of the building and halting for a moment before going on. Were there more of them? It didn't seem possible. What he saw descending from the black chasm weren't men. They were alien, from some other world, some other dimension, sliding through this slit, this break in the shell of the universe, entering through this gap, winged insects from another realm of being. On the steps of the city hall, a group of men broke up. A few moved toward a waiting car. One of the remaining shapes started to re-enter the city hall. It changed its mind and turned to follow the others. Lois closed his eyes in horror. His senses reeled. He hung on tight, clutching at the sagging fence. The shape, the man shape, had abruptly fluttered up and flapped after the others. It flew to the sidewalk and came to rest among them. Pseudo-men, imitation men. Insects with ability to disguise themselves as men, like other insects familiar to Earth. Protective coloration. Mimicry. Lois pulled himself away. He got slowly to his feet. It was night. The alley was totally dark. But maybe they could see in the dark. Maybe darkness made no difference to them. He left the alley cautiously and moved out onto the street. Men and women flowed past, but not so many now. At the bus stop stood waiting groups. A huge bus lumbered along the street, its lights flashing in the evening gloom. Lois moved forward. He pushed his way among those waiting, and when the bus halted, he boarded it and took a seat in the rear by the door. A moment later, the bus moved into life and rumbled down the street. Lois relaxed a little. He studied the people around him, dulled, tired faces, people going home from work. Quite ordinary faces. None of them paid any attention to him. All sat quietly, sunk down in their seats, jiggling with the motion of the bus. The man sitting next to him unfolded a newspaper. He began to read the sports section, his lips moving. An ordinary man, blue suit, tie, a businessman or a salesman, on his way home to his wife and family. Across the aisle, a young woman, perhaps 20, dark eyes and hair, a package on her lap, nylons and heels, red coat and white angora sweater, gazing absently ahead of her. A high school boy in jeans and black jacket. A great triple-chinned woman with an immense shopping bag loaded with packages and parcels, her thick face dim with weariness. Ordinary people, the kind that rode the bus every evening, going home to their families, to dinner. Going home, with their minds dead, controlled, filmed over with the mask of an alien being that had appeared and taken possession of them, their town, their lives, himself, too, except that he happened to be deep in his cellar instead of in the store. Somehow, he had been overlooked. They had missed him. Their control wasn't perfect, foolproof. Maybe there were others. Hope flickered in Lois. They weren't omnipotent. They had made a mistake, not got control of him. Their net, their field of control, had passed him over. He had emerged from his cellar as he had gone down. Apparently, their power zone was limited. A few seats down the aisle, a man was watching him. Lois broke off his chain of thought. A slender man with dark hair and a small mustache. Well-dressed brown suit and shiny shoes. A book between his small hands. He was watching Lois, studying him intently. He turned quickly away. Lois tensed. One of them? Or another they had missed? The man was watching him again. Small, dark eyes, alive and clever. Shrewd. A man too shrewd for them. Or one of the things itself. An alien insect from beyond. The bus halted. An elderly man got on slowly and dropped his token into the box. He moved down the aisle and took a seat opposite Lois. The elderly man caught the sharp-eyed man's gaze. For a split second, something passed between them. A look, rich with meaning. Lois got to his feet. The bus was moving. He ran to the door. One step down into the well, he yanked the emergency door release. The rubber door swung open. "Hey!" the driver shouted, jamming on the brakes. "What the hell?" Lois squirmed through. The bus was slowing down. Houses on all sides. A residential district, lawns and tall apartment buildings. Behind him, the bright-eyed man had leaped up. The elderly man was also on his feet. They were coming after him. Lois leaped. He hit the pavement with terrific force and rolled against the curb. Pain lapped over him. Pain and a vast tide of blackness. Desperately, he fought it off. He struggled to his knees and then slid down again. The bus had stopped. People were getting off. Lois groped around, his fingers closed over something. A rock lying in the gutter. He crawled to his feet, grunting with pain. A shape loomed before him. A man. The bright-eyed man with the book. Lois kicked. The man gasped and fell. Lois brought the rock down. The man screamed and tried to roll away. "Stop! For God's sake, listen!" He struck again. A hideous crunching sound. The man's voice cut off and dissolved into a bubbling wail. Lois scrambled up and back. The others were there now, all around him. He ran, awkwardly, down the sidewalk, up a driveway. None of them followed him. They had stopped and were bending over the inert body of the man with the book, the bright-eyed man who had come after him. Had he made a mistake? But it was too late to worry about that. He had to get out, away from them. Out of Pikeville, beyond the crack of darkness, the rent between their world and his. "Ed!" Janet Lois backed away nervously. "What is it? What?" Ed Lois slammed the door behind him and came into the living room. "Pull down the shades, quick!" Janet moved toward the window. "But do as I say. Who else is here beside you?" "Nobody. Just the twins. They're upstairs in their room. What's happened? You look so strange. Why are you home?" Ed locked the front door. He prowled around the house, into the kitchen. From the drawer under the sink, he slid out a big butcher knife and ran his finger along it. Sharp, plenty sharp. He returned to the living room. "Listen to me," he said. "I don't have much time. They know I escaped, and they'll be looking for me." "Escape?" Janet's face twisted with bewilderment and fear. "Who?" "The town has been taken over. They're in control. I've got it pretty well figured out. They started at the top, at the city hall and police department. What they did with the real humans, they..." "What are you talking about? We've been invaded from some other universe, some other dimension. They're insects, mimicry, and more. Power to control minds, your mind, my mind. Their entrance is here in Pikeville. They've taken over all of you, the whole town, except me. We're up against an incredibly powerful enemy, but they have their limitations. That's our hope. They're limited. They can make mistakes." Janet shook her head. "I don't understand, Ed. You must be insane." "Insane? No, just lucky. If I hadn't been down in the basement, I'd be all like the rest of you." Lois peered out the window. But I can't stand here talking. Get your coat. My coat? We're getting out of here, out of Pikeville. We've got to get help fight this thing. They can be beaten. They're not infallible. It's going to be close, but we may make it if we hurry. Come on. He grabbed her arm roughly. Get your coat and call the twins. We're all leaving. Don't stop to pack. There's no time for that. White-faced, his wife moved toward the closet and got down her coat. Where are we going? Ed pulled the desk drawer and spilled the contents out onto the floor. He grabbed up a road map and spread it open. They'll have the highway covered, of course, but there's a back road to Oak Grove. I got onto it once. It's practically abandoned. Maybe they'll forget about it. The old ranch road? Good Lord, it's completely closed. Nobody's supposed to drive over it. I know. Ed thrust the map grimly into his coat. That's our best chance. Now call down the twins and let's get going. Your car is full of gas, isn't it? Janet was dazed. The Chevy? I had it filled up yesterday afternoon. Janet moved toward the stairs. Ed, I... Call the twins. Ed unlocked the front door and peered out. Nothing stirred. No sign of life. All right so far. Come on downstairs, Janet called in a wavering voice. We're going out for a while. Now? Tommy's voice came. Hurry up, Ed barked. Get down here, both of you. Tommy appeared at the top of the stairs. I was doing my homework. We're starting fractions. Miss Parker says if we don't get this done, you can forget about fractions. Ed grabbed his son as he came down the stair and propelled him toward the door. Where's Jim? He's coming. Jim started slowly down the stairs. What's up, Dad? We're going for a ride. A ride? Where? Ed turned to Janet. We'll leave the lights on in the TV set. Go turn it on. He pushed her toward the set so they'll think we're still. He heard the buzz and dropped instantly, the long butcher knife out. Sickened, he saw it coming down the stairs at him, wings a blur of motion as it aimed itself. It still bore a vague resemblance to Jimmy. It was a small, a baby one, a brief glimpse, the thing hurtling at him, cold, multi-lensed, inhuman eyes, wings, body still clothed in yellow T-shirt and jeans, the mimic outline still stamped on it, a strange half-turn of its body as it reached him. What was it doing? A stinger. Lois stabbed wildly at it. It retreated, buzzing frantically. Lois rolled and crawled toward the door. Tommy and Janet stood still as statues, faces blank, watching without expression. Lois stabbed again. This time the knife connected. The thing shrieked and faltered. It bounced against the wall and fluttered down. Something lapped through his mind. A wall of force, energy, an alien mind probing into him. He was suddenly paralyzed. The mind entered his own, touched against him briefly, shockingly, an utterly alien presence settling over him. And then it flickered out as the thing collapsed in a broken heap on the rug. It was dead. He turned it over with his foot. It was an insect, a fly of some kind. Yellowed T-shirt, jeans. His son, Jimmy. He closed his mind tight. It was too late to think about that. Savagely, he scooped up his knife and headed toward the door. Janet and Tommy stood stone still, neither of them moving. The car was out. He'd never get through. They'd be waiting for him. It was 10 miles on foot. 10 long miles over rough ground, gullies and open fields and hills of uncut forest. He'd have to go alone. Lois opened the door. For a brief second, he looked back at his wife and son. Then he slammed the door behind him and raced down the porch steps. A moment later, he was on his way, hurrying swiftly through the darkness toward the edge of town. The early morning sunlight was blinding. Lois halted, gasping for breath, swaying back and forth. Sweat ran down in his eyes. His clothing was torn, shredded by the brush and thorns through which he had crawled 10 miles, on his hands and knees, crawling, creeping through the night. His shoes were mud-caked. He was scratched and limping, utterly exhausted. But ahead of him lay Oak Grove. He took a deep breath and started down the hill. Twice he stumbled and fell, picking himself up and trudging on. His ears rang. Everything receded and wavered. But he was there. He had got out, awake, from Pikeville. A farmer in a field gaped at him. From a house, a young woman watched in wonder. Lois reached the road and turned onto it. Ahead of him was a gasoline station and a drive-in, a couple of trucks, some chickens pecking in the dirt, a dog tied with a string. The white-clad attendant watched suspiciously as he dragged himself up to the station. Thank God, he caught hold of the wall. I didn't think I was going to make it. They followed me most of the way. I could hear them buzzing, buzzing and flitting around behind me. What happened? The attendant demanded. You in a wreck? A holdup? Lois shook his head wearily. They have the whole town, the city hall and the police station. They hung a man from the lamppost. That was the first thing I saw. They've got all the roads blocked. I saw them hovering over the cars coming in. About 4 this morning, I got beyond them. I knew it right away. I could feel them leave. And then the sun came up. The attendant licked his lip nervously. You're out of your head. I better get a doctor. Get me into Oak Grove, Lois gasped. He sank down on the gravel. We've got to get started. Cleaning them out. Got to get started right away. They kept a tape recorder going all the time he talked. When he had finished, the commissioner snapped off the recorder and got to his feet. He stood for a moment, deep in thought. Finally, he got out his cigarettes and lit up slowly, a frown on his beefy face. You don't believe me, Lois said. The commissioner offered him a cigarette. Lois pushed it impatiently away. Suit yourself. The commissioner moved over to the window and stood for a time looking out at the town of Oak Grove. I believe you, he said abruptly. Lois sagged. Thank God. So you got away. The commissioner shook his head. You were down in your cellar instead of at work. A freak chance. One in a million. Lois sipped some of the black coffee they had brought him. I have a theory, he murmured. What is it? About them. Who they are. They take over one area at a time, starting at the top, the highest level of authority, working down from there in a widening circle. When they're firmly in control, they go on to the next town. They spread slowly, very gradually. I think it's been going on for a long time. A long time? Thousands of years. I don't think it's new. Why do you say that? When I was a kid, a picture they showed us in Bible League, a religious picture, an old print, the enemy gods defeated by Jehovah, Moloch, Beelzebub, Moab, Balin, Ashtaroth. So? They were all represented by figures. Lois looked up at the commissioner. Beelzebub was presented as a giant fly. The commissioner grunted. An old struggle. They've been defeated. The Bible is an account of their defeats. They make gains, but finally they're defeated. Why defeated? They can't get everyone. They didn't get me, and they never got the Hebrews. The Hebrews carried the message to the whole world, the realization of the danger. The two men on the bus, I think they understood, had escaped like I did. He clenched his fists. I killed one of them. I made a mistake. I was afraid to take a chance. The commissioner nodded. Yes, they undoubtedly had escaped, as you did. Freak accidents, but the rest of the town was firmly in control. He turned from the window. Well, Mr. Lois, you seem to have figured everything out. Not everything. The hanging man. The dead man hanging from the lamppost. I don't understand that. Why? Why did they deliberately hang him there? That would seem simple, the commissioner smiled faintly. Bait. Lois stiffened. His heart stopped beating. Bait? What do you mean? To draw you out. Make you declare yourself so they'd know who was under control and who had escaped. Lois recoiled with horror. Then they expected failures. They anticipated. He broke off. They were ready with a trap. And you showed yourself. You reacted. You made yourself known. The commissioner abruptly moved toward the door. Come along, Lois. There's a lot to do. We must get moving. There's no time to waste. Lois started slowly to his feet, numbed. And the man? Who was the man? I never saw him before. He wasn't a local man. He was a stranger. All muddy and dirty, his face cut, slashed. There was a strange look on the commissioner's face as he answered. Maybe, he said softly. You'll understand that, too. Come along with me, Mr. Lois. He held the door open, his eyes gleaming. Lois caught a glimpse of the street in front of the police station. Policeman, a platform of some sort, a telephone pole, and a rope. Right this way, the commissioner said, smiling coldly. As the sun set, the vice president of the Oak Grove Merchants Bank came up out of the vault, threw the heavy time locks, put on his hat and coat, and hurried outside onto the sidewalk. Only a few people were there, hurrying home to dinner. "Good night," the guard said, locking the door after him. "Good night," Clarence Mason murmured. He started along the street toward his car. He was tired. He had been working all day down in the vault, examining the layout of the safety deposit boxes to see if there was room for another tier. He was glad to be finished. At the corner, he halted. The street lights had not yet come on. The street was dim. Everything was vague. He looked around and froze. From the telephone pole in front of the police station, something large and shapeless hung. It moved a little with the wind. What the hell was it? Mason approached it warily. He wanted to get home. He was tired and hungry. He thought of his wife, his kids, a hot meal on the dinner table. But there was something about the dark bundle, something ominous and ugly. The light was bad. He couldn't tell what it was. Yet it drew him on, made him move closer for a better look. The shapeless thing made him uneasy. He was frightened by it, frightened and fascinated. And the strange part was that nobody else seemed to notice it.